You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hello, I'm Dave Hendon. Welcome to the latest edition of the Snooker Scene podcast. This week, a player who is perhaps a little misunderstood. It's Mark Allen from Northern Ireland. He's been a pro since 2005, and this is his chance to tell us, in his own words, about his life and career in snooker. Mark, how did you get into snooker? What was your introduction?
Probably just the boring, usual way. My dad used to play, and he used to take me and my brother every Sunday down to the local social club. Once a week, really. Started from there, and then after I got a bit more interest in it, I couldn't go to the club that my dad took me to anything but Sunday. So he sent me to the local snooker club then, and used to go down maybe two or three days a week, always after a football match on a Saturday, and then just grew from there. There was a lot of ones in the club that I played at that were doing really well in the amateur scene. I think four of the top six in the country at the time were all from that club, so quite fortunate at the time. I had good practice partners and they all helped me along.
And also, you're from part of the world, Northern Ireland. They've got these two legends, Alex Higgins, Dennis Taylor, both world champions. Snooker really popular in that part of the world when you were growing up.
Yeah, it was. I remember talking to a few of the guys in the club recently. Andrum's a very small town, I think a population of about 50 or 60,000. I think at one stage there was about 50 or 60 snooker tables across like three or four different clubs, and you used to have to queue for tables. That's how popular it was. Unfortunately now we're down to I think maybe 10. It is getting back a little bit. I know from personal experience in the club I play at, it died off a little bit, but it definitely seems to be a bit of a resurgence. But what Alex and Dennis done for Northern Ireland snooker as a whole is no second to none. No, and we have to thank them for that. Myself, Joe Swale, and all the ones that are coming through,
But do you think you were good right away? Were you naturally talented, or did you improve the sort of more competitions you played, or was it a bit of both? Maybe
a bit of both. Like at the start I was useless the way everyone is, but I think I picked it up pretty quick. I was able to make 30s and 40s pretty quickly. Made my first century after playing for maybe just under a year. I think that's pretty good. Yeah, and then just played in every tournament I possibly could. I had to put the football sort of in the back burner, and they always used to clash with the junior tournaments on a Saturday morning. So, yeah, I used to go to all the snooker events on Saturday. It took me quite a while to win my first match. I lost agonisingly on the black many times. And then eventually I won a match and won a couple of matches. Then I won my first tournament. It was the Northern Ireland Under-14s. And then just went from there, really. I won pretty much everything at junior level and senior level back home. And, yeah, it gave me good confidence getting into the pro scene. It's all right. Some people, I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but some people that have done nothing in the amateur scene and get free Q school, they're maybe not ready. Whereas I felt like I was ready straight away because I'd won the World Amateurs, won the European Championships, won the European Under-19s, and won everything in Northern Ireland. So I felt like I was coming in the back of a lot of good wins. So I was very, very confident starting out.
Yeah, I think people may not know this. I mean, you won literally every, as you say, in every age division. You won the Northern Ireland title. Like you say, you won the European Juniors, European Championship, World Amateur. So you've done everything as an amateur, hadn't you? Maybe that's why you were so confident when you turned pro.
Yeah, it was disappointing for me that I turned pro without winning the World Under-21s, because I don't think anyone's ever won all four. I lost in the semis to Louis Song, who was on the tour for many years, and the other semi-final that year was Ding against Robertson.
Right, yeah.
So it was a strong field.
Yeah, yeah.
Disappointing not to win that, but it gave me so much confidence to get in to the pro game. And obviously I was very fortunate getting an invite to the Northern Ireland Trophy. You know, my very first tournament. Yeah. Not many people get their first ever pro match live on TV in their hometown.
How did you feel about that then? Because you're going and you're playing Steve Davis, you know, a legend, on telly, in, like you say, in your home country.
I'll be honest and say that if I'm looking back on it now, I was very, very fortunate and it was an unbelievable experience. But at the time, I didn't think about it.
Right.
It was just another match for me. And yes, it was one that I was looking forward to. And playing Davis, obviously, legend of the game. But it was just another match for me that I was trying to win. And I know it sounds silly saying that. Coming into the game, I was at a complete nobody. And my first match is against the Nugget. Not many people are getting into it like that. But I think because I'd won so much as a youngster, that I was just wanting to win.
Yeah.
And obviously I beat him, I beat Higgins. And even playing Hendry in the quarterfinal, like, I wanted to win. And obviously looking back on it now, it was probably naive to think that I could. But it was just the confidence I had at the time. Yeah.
But to beat, okay, so you beat Davis. At that time, he was a little bit on the slide, but John Higgins wasn't. I mean, he was very much a top player. So that win, I mean, did you even think about what it meant then? Or was it, like you say, you're just doing what you've always done, which is playing matches?
Just playing matches. Yeah. I was riding the crest of a wave, though, obviously winning lots of matches as an amateur. But to sort of do it on the big stage like that, in front of my home crowd as well, whenever I was getting fantastic support, considering I was a complete nobody, to be able to do it on that big stage was good for me. And it was an experience in itself playing Hendry. He was the person I looked up to the most coming through. And just to play him, my first event, even though I got absolutely pumped.
Yeah.
I remember actually watching him, and he had a presence around the table and an aura. And I remember playing him later that year in the UK Championships, and I had to not look at him because I felt like I was a bit starstruck because I was just coming in. But they're all part and parcel of the learning curve. And I'm very, very fortunate at the time that me and Joe Sweel get invited to that tournament, because I think that set me on the right path straight away.
But then, of course, after that, you go back to what is normal for a new pro, the qualifiers, which is a very different setup. No real crowd.
Yeah.
You're not playing the legends. You're playing the people around you in the rankings. But how did you sort of adjust to that?
Again, it didn't bother me because I was used to playing amateur tournaments with no one watching.
Yeah.
It was an out-of-body experience playing the Northern Ireland Trophy because there was lots of people watching. But in general, I was used to playing in front of nobody. It sounds like I'm really, really lucky here, but my first qualifier, I played a guy called James Tatton, and he turned up late after the interval and got up the frame, and I won 5-0 there.
Right.
So, you know, not a lot of people get their first match handed to them like that either. But obviously, it was 4-0 up, but probably would have been done on one, but we'll never know that. But yeah, it was just those little things went for me. It was strange because at the time there was only 6 or 7 tournaments, big gaps. Even I think there was a 4 or 5 week gap from that qualifier to the main event. And in that time, we found out that Rhiann was pregnant.
Right.
And my head was completely gone at the time because it was just not something we'd planned for, and still very young. And I was very, very lucky that there was a 5 week gap because my head just wasn't in the right place. And I remember my first match after that was a qualifier against Scott McKenzie. And I was 8-all. It was for the UK. 8-all, first and 9. And I managed to make an 84 in the last frame. And I only remember it because it was, I think it was 12 reds, 12 pinks.
Right.
And I still say to this day, if I'd lost that match, I could possibly have dropped off tour because I was in such a bad place mentally because we just weren't expecting to have a little one and weren't ready for it. And once I got that match under my belt, it sort of got my head back in the game and ended up going on to qualify for the UK. I beat David Gray at the UK Championships and lost to the Nugget then, 9-7, the year he got to the final against Ding.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very, very fortunate there was that big gap because if it had been like it is now, and there's a 5 week spell of tournament, probably could have went bad for me.
Yeah, I think after that, though, you did settle in pretty well, didn't you? And you got to the Crucible 2007. It's a big deal for it. It's like a rite of passage for a snooker player to play there. And you've gone out and beaten Ken Doherty in the first round.
Yeah, I keep saying it, but it was just another match. Yeah.
Why though? Because like that is a big deal to walk down those steps.
Don't get me wrong, and, like, coming out of the Crucible, I was buzzing, hair in the back of my neck standing up, and it took me a while to settle, even though I won the first 4 frames. I still felt edgy.
Yeah.
And then when it got close, I'm quite happy that it went close, because if I'd have won, I'm not saying this would ever happen, but if I'd have won 10-0, it wouldn't have been the same because you don't get that punch back and you don't know how you'd handle it, whereas Doherty threw everything at me and I managed to still beat him. But at the time it was just another game. I'd won so many matches. You're going there not expecting to win the tournament. I'm by this stage I'm sort of experienced enough to know that I'm not going to be one of the favourites to win the tournament. So I'm going there to try and enjoy it, and I did. You know, even though I lost in the second round to Matthew Stevens, I enjoyed every minute of it. I probably enjoyed the Stevens match more than I did the Doherty match. But you had to play at the Crucible every year special, not just the first year. Every year special, I'm still going there now. You know, I've been there 10 or 11 years in a row. You know, going there every year special and something that you not quite get used to.
I think it was the year later when you lost to Hendry in the first round.
Yeah.
And that was the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
A real hard defeat to take.
Yeah, that's still probably one of my hardest ever defeats. 9-7 up, and I remember I missed the pink in the middle. It's funny how you remember things, but looking back on it now, I probably should have just made sure of the pink and played safe on the last red, because it would have been 35 up with 35 on. And I tried to force the pink to get on, close to the red, and of course Hendry does what he does, clears up, does a one visit in the decider. But I think it was more heartbreaking at the time, because it would have been great to beat Hendry at the Crucible. Obviously he's the Crucible King, but I needed to win that match again in the 16. As it turned out, no few results went my way, and I managed to finish number 16 anyway. But at the time I didn't know that, and I was devastated. And it's probably one of the hardest defeats I've ever had, but it's all experience. There's going to be many, many hard defeats in this game, and they hurt a lot more probably than the wins that you get, but you learn so much more from them.
Yeah, and you were still young. I mean, you're like 22, I think, at the time. And when you're 22, you don't know how young that is, do you? But I'm just wondering, like, you know, you've played snooker up to that point for many years already. What were your sort of ambitions? Did you go into it thinking, right, I want to be, you know, world champion, I want to do this, that and the other? Or was it just, okay, I'm just playing snooker like I always have done?
Probably a bit of both. I'm still more in the mindset of I'm just playing snooker, but because I'd won so many matches and on the verge of the 16 after towards the end of my third season, I was so confident. You know, although I hadn't been to sort of many later stages, I think a couple of semis or something maybe at that stage, but I was just winning so many matches. But it was under the old structure, the tier system, where you were playing people of a similar rank in early doors, and I think that helped me so much along the way, because as much as I back my ability, if I'm thrown in the deep end straight away first round like it is now, and I'm constantly playing top player, top player, top player, the chances are you're not going to win many of those games and you'll drop off tour. So yeah, fortunate that I came through the tiered system. I think it was a far better structure. But I was just so confident I won so many matches.
Yeah, yeah. Then 2009 at the Crucible, you got to the semis. What was that like, being suddenly in the one table setup?
Yeah, that was awesome. That's the best experience I've ever had at the Crucible. Now, I've had some one-off matches where I've played really good snooker and won easy, but as a whole, that whole tournament, I flew through the whole tournament. You know, I beat Ronnie in round two, beat Randy, who was flying. He was the top, I think he was number 6 in the world at the time. And then I'm playing Higgins in the semis, and the one table setup is completely different to anything you'll ever experience. You go from being claustrophobic and sitting right next to your opponent, near being able to touch the table when you're in your seat, to feeling like you've all the room in the world. And the second session in particular, Higgins played flawless, and I didn't feel like I'd done that much wrong, and he beat me 7-1. I didn't feel involved in the game at all, and because you're sitting so far away, it adds to that, you don't feel involved. But proud of myself, from 13-3 down, I got back in the match. I had Higgins on the ropes a little bit, and I just a bit of an experience. I got a bit excited twice in the last session. I missed two easy balls that I shouldn't have missed. But other than that, I was so happy with the way I played from 13-3 down. Honestly, could have made it 15-all from 13-3 down, and not many people ever do that. But disappointing now that I haven't got back to that one table setup. I think it was maybe the next year I lost 13-12 to Dot in the quarters. And that was one where I felt like I could win the tournament. That was the first time I'd really, even though I got to the semis against Higgins, that year against Dot was the first time I actually thought I can win this. I was 12-10 up, missed one shot into the middle pocket, never seen another ball. He made 3-1 visits. But that is the standard you have to play at the Crucible. I understand that, but I felt like that year was possibly my year, and I let one go there.
So you were sort of, you'd become a top player very much, and you were sort of knocking on the door for titles, and it wasn't quite happening, was it? You got to the UK final against Trump, and it was you made a great comeback there as well. It just didn't quite get over the line. Was that sort of frustrating? Because at that time everyone was sort of talking about you as a tournament winner. It wasn't quite happening at that point for you, was it?
Yeah, it was frustrating, but look, I don't really care about what people say. You know, I think at that time I'd lost 8 semi-finals in a row without ever reaching a final, so it was like a monkey off my back beating Ricky Walden there. Even though I lost in the final against Trump, I lost the better player on the day. I had no qualms about that. I played right and well, and Trump just played that little bit better. I always felt that a tournament win was not far away. It didn't matter to me what people kept saying in the press about semi-final this, semi-final that. It didn't matter to me that, because I knew I had the talent, I had the belief in myself that I was going to win. So it was just a matter of time to keep doing what you're doing on the practice table, and hopefully it'll come. And yeah. It did.
Well, it came at the World Open 2012 in Haikou, China. I think it's fair to say you didn't necessarily enjoy the week off the table. We know that. You didn't enjoy it. But it didn't seem to affect you on the table.
No, I think when you're out there, you just play, don't you? Mm. And look, it was still to this day, it's one of the worst places I've ever been. The facilities were dreadful. But I think I've learned to deal with that a bit better than what I did then. Mm. But yeah, when you get out there to play, you're playing on the same 12 by 6. You're not thinking about the dead cats that are in the roof and all that there sort of thing. But yeah, I don't know what happened that week. I won a couple of deciding frames against Trump and against Selby, I think the last 16 in the semi-final. And they're the matches that you need to be on the right side of. No, they easily could have lost those matches. But I remember I finished my first four matches in that tournament with a century in the last frame. And two of them were in deciding frames, so I knew my game was in good shape. Didn't expect to win the final the way I did. I couldn't have played really any better. I beat Stephen Lee 10-1, so it was a good way to win my first. But in a way, it's a bit disappointing as well, because you want your first to be dramatic, you want your first to be exciting, whereas I played that well. It wasn't ever a contest, and I don't mean that in any disrespectful way towards Stephen Lee. I just had a day where I didn't miss a ball really. But you want your first to be like sort of a 10-9 on the black, sure, and show that you've got a bit of grit and a bit of bottle. But I'll take them when they come.
Yeah. I think also that week it was a little sort of window into the sort of isolation that players can feel when they're away from home. And you've spoken about sort of mental health issues as well, and just sort of loneliness, because it's a very lonely sport, isn't it, snooker?
It is, and it's something I still struggle with to this day. Like, I hate being away from home, I hate being overseas, but it is part and parcel of what we do. I've learned to deal with it a bit better, but it's something I still really, really don't enjoy. I'd nothing rather than be at home and see my wife and my little girl, and know just the normal things you do as a family, and that's the hardest part. You know, the rewards are great if you're doing really well in the game, but what I have a question is, if you're not sort of one of the top 16, is it worth that sacrifice? And I know that to make a sport, there's going to be lots of ones that don't make the top 16. There's ones that struggle to stay on tour, sort of ones that make up the numbers, but yeah, is it really worth the sacrifice to miss all that whenever you're not making any money?
How sort of low did you feel? I mean, were you were depressed, right?
Yeah, very. I've spoke openly about it, like, and something I've no problem talking with at all now, because I feel like I'm in a much better place. But yeah, it was hard. There was lots of times where I felt like I just didn't want to be there anymore. Nothing. I never ever tried to take my own life or anything like that. No. But I did feel that low at times, and I lived on my own, and I bought a house and stayed on my own, and I just used to stay in the house, and it sounds really bad, like listen to just sad music, just sit in my bedroom and not move, and like that's what I'd done for days. And like it's a vicious circle, because the more you do that, the worse you feel. But it just took a few good friends and family in order to get me out of that. You know, sort of started talking a little bit more. I went and seen a psychologist, and talking to him as a stranger was really, really good for me. I felt like I could talk to him a lot more openly than I could to someone that knew me. I don't know why that was, but I just felt more comfortable. But with talking to him, I was able to talk to friends and family then a bit more openly about it, and that got me right through it. And now the same people I'd talked to then sort of know the signs to look for if I ever sort of have a relapse type thing. But I don't feel like that's ever going to happen again. I feel like I've got good people around me, very, very settled off the table, and my snooker's in a good place. So yeah, everything's going well there.
That's good, because snooker, you have to be very introspective and sort of inward looking to play it in a way, don't you? You have to sort of get in that zone that they talk about. And I think a lot of players maybe don't always get out of that when they're away from the table. Did you sort of find that as well, that you were sort of almost sort of trapped in your own mind in a way a little bit?
Possibly. You have to be selfish in this game. You're playing for yourself at the end of the day, but I think in the recent years in particular, I've become more open. You know, sounds like silly things to say, but it's things I wasn't doing, just socialising at tournaments. Now, I would never have sat with another player at dinner because I wanted to stay in my bubble, but just lent itself to bad things. And now I go out all the time for dinner and a couple of drinks with like Sean and Stevie Maguire and people like that, Tom Ford. Just I've got good people around me now, even in the snooker world. Socialising is a massive thing for me now. I feel like if I can do that and not isolate myself in the room, then I'm doing something right.
Good. And do you think, because as I say, part of that initial World Open win, you were fined, I think, for things you said on Twitter. Do you think that what you were saying was part of what you've just described, that sort of isolation that you felt?
Possibly.
Reaction against it, maybe?
Yeah, possibly, but a lot of what I said was true.
Right.
Some people don't like the truth, and I still stand by what I said at the time. The place was disgusting. Something that Wordsnicker have improved definitely on over the last lot of years. We're going to slightly better places. There's still one or two that aren't very good. But in general, the places that we go to now are better facilities, just better food places, better accommodation, things like that. But at the time, like, that was disgraceful where we were. And you know, I was just saying what a lot of players were already saying. And maybe not saying it in the correct way, but there's a lot of truth in what I said, and people just don't like it.
Yeah, I think you're right, a lot of people would have felt the same, but not everyone says it. You don't mind saying it, do you?
No,
if you want to.
It's my life at the end of the day, and I feel like I should be able to say these things. Obviously, there's been some things in the past that I've said that, not that I wish I didn't say them, but I wish I'd said them better. I think perhaps the way I've said things over the years gets swept under the carpet because of how I say it, and what I'm actually meaning within that gets lost. You know, it's been well documented about, you know, the Chinese thing, and I'll get fined heavily for that, but there is a lot of truth in what I say. Maybe the way I said it at the time was completely wrong, and I hold my hands up for that, but there is a lot of truth in it. You know, I'm not the only one that says it, and it's been, you know, shown on TV and things like that, and it's something that could be clamped down on. It has improved a lot, but at the time, yeah, I was really, really frustrated, and I felt like these sort of things were—they were an added thing as to why I wasn't doing better, and they were costing me money for financial terms. Things were, and these things get to you. You know, like, especially when you're on your own all the time,
yeah,
and you're constantly thinking over about this and that, and
it's something you've had to learn, I guess, to
I think now
trying to put pressure on yourself by getting involved.
I'm still quite
that,
vocal, but I think I've learned to be a bit more level-headed in the way I express things. It can get expensive.
But also, like, one tweet late at night does not reflect who you are as a person, does it? You know, I mean, we're sat here chatting nicely now, you know. It's not like you're just a sort of raging ball of fire all the time. Not at all.
No, not at all. But, look, I'm an expressive person and I'm an emotional person, but I think, unfortunately for me, and I can't change it, some people are always going to tar me with that brush. That, you know, I get called a racist all the time by certain people on social media, and that's not who I am.
No,
like, I maybe made a bad comment or two, but that's not who I am at all. I'm just an emotional person. I express my views on things, and I wish I could change some things about the way I said it, but it is me, and I'm not going to change. I think, well, deep down, I'll always know the ones that are close to me, my family, friends, you know, in my close circle. They always know who I am, and that's all that'll ever really matter to me.
And you're also, I mean, this is not so much a question as just a kind of comment, really. You're incredibly sporting in the arena. I mean, you really are. And that's just something you've always been from being a kid, or is that the respect you have for snooker?
I think it's the way I've been brought up. You know, it's a sport. There's going to be a winner and loser on every day. Some defeats are a lot harder to take than others, but sometimes you have to appreciate good shots, good performances. And I think that's all part and parcel of the game. We're fortunate in snooker that that's been, you know, the trait over many, many years, that snooker does go down that route, but it's something that's being lost a little, I think. There's not enough of that. And people might say maybe me showing that I'm too nice out there. That's not the case at all. Like, I want to kill my opponent when I'm playing. But within that, there's, you know, there's well documented about, like, my thing with Mark Joyce and things like that. But even when I played him, if he played a good shot, I'd tap the table because he played a good shot. It's nothing to do with him as a person. So, like, I think that's something I'll always have.
What's the deal with you and Mark Joyce?
I just don't see eye to eye. There's been a bit of history in the past from previous...
Did it start when you were kids, or...?
Not really. He seems to think that I don't like him because he beat me a few times as a junior. If that was the case, there would be a lot of people I didn't like. No. But that's not the case at all. I just don't particularly like him as a person. You know, there's 131 players now on tour. You're not going to like every one of them, and he happens to be one that I don't particularly like, but... Look, it is what it is, and it's in the past now. We'll move on. We've actually spoke and had a few drinks since and tried to put it behind us, so hopefully that's the end of it.
Okay. You're 32 next month, February, so you're still a young man, but you've been a pro a long time, actually, now.
Yeah.
How do you sort of sum up your career at this point? Are you satisfied what you achieved? Could you have done more?
I definitely feel like I should have done more by now. Very disappointed in where I am at the minute, with just three ranking events and 1-9 tournaments in total, but... it's not good enough for a thing for me, but I don't mean that in any big-headed way. I just feel like I've missed a few years where in my early 20s, sort of mid-20s, I was partying a bit too much and really enjoyed single life, and I was living on my own, so my house turned into a bit of a party house, and didn't practice as much, and at the time it didn't affect me on the table. I was very, very fortunate. But I think that had a knock-on effect that a few years down the line, when I got my head right and I was practicing more, karma come back.
Yeah.
And I started to go bad, and I wasn't winning many matches. Always enough to stay in the 16, but never felt like I was ever threatening. And I think that was just me getting what I deserved for those few years where I abused it myself, I abused the game. I think that's sort of why I haven't won as much as I should have. But there's a lot of players that would love to win 9 tournaments.
Sure.
But for me personally, I want to go on and win a lot more. I sort of set myself a target of, if I could finish my playing career and have as many tournament wins as years on tour, then I'd be reasonably happy. Now, for me to do that, I'd probably have to win a couple a season now to catch up, but I still feel that's well within my grasp.
You've not yet won a Triple Crown event. That would be, I guess, an immediate ambition.
Yeah, it would, but look, it's easy to say that, isn't it? It's easy to say I want to win a Worlds, I want to win a UK, I want to win the Masters, but it's just doesn't work like that.
No,
I try my very, very best in every tournament I play in, whether it's Gibraltar Open for 18 grand a winner or the World Championships at 425. No, the financial side of it isn't what's important to me, although you need money to survive and whatever. But I want to win. I want to win tournaments, and I don't ever enter a tournament where I feel like I can't win. And it just so happened up to this date that I haven't won one yet. But it doesn't mean that I've prepared badly. I've just maybe been outplayed in those tournaments. And all I can ever keep doing, it's always something that sounds so boring to say, but just keep working hard on the practice table, which I feel like I really have done. And hopefully the results will turn. And there's many, many players, myself included, that might look back in their career and never won one. But it doesn't mean that I haven't tried hard enough to win it. It's just maybe something that's not meant to be, but I still feel like I've got the game to win all three.
Snooker, professional snooker in the circuit has changed quite dramatically in the time you've been professional. How do you sort of see it at the moment? How's the state of the game at the moment?
It's funny because Barry Hearn made a statement whenever he first took over that it's going to get to the stage where players complain there's too much snooker. I'm nearly there. It's very, very hard. Obviously, me and my wife have just had another little girl. She's only 5 months. I hate being away from home. I hate missing her grow up. It's my massive regret to do with Lauren. No, I don't see Lauren really at all. And part of that has to do with snooker, and part of it's to do with me. I wasn't a good father. And I think I'd love to be able to spend more time at home. But the rewards now are so much greater. I think we've got 25 events on the calendar at the minute. You'll probably be able to tell me, like, close to 12 million in prize money or something like that.
It's certainly gone up massively, hasn't it?
Oh, it is. It's amazing what he's done in such a short space of time. But what I wonder is, within all that, is the quality dropping? I don't mean as an individual events, because the quality is still good in any event, but I mean as a whole, can players be as consistent as they possibly want to be with so many events? What Selby's done is astronomical. To be, like, number one for 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Like, in the current system, that's unreal, but in a way it's not, because if you win the Worlds, you're going to be top two anyway. Unless you fall apart the rest of the 2 years. But in an ideal world, I'd love it to get to the stage where there's maybe a few tournaments less, but the money and the events that are left for us to play in goes up a bit. Like, there's tournaments that we play in that, in the grand scheme of things, aren't going to make any difference to my ranking. They're not going to change my life in any way, but you feel like if you don't play in, you're missing a step, especially with that, where I am in the rankings at the minute. I need to be winning a lot of matches. It is a bit too much, I think, at the minute. The travelling is grueling. Barry will say, you know, tough shit sort of thing, but it is very, very hard, and it's something I would love to change.
You've had a couple of run-ins with Barry Hearn. I'm going to put you on the spot here. What would you give him out of 10 for what he's done while he's been chairman?
10.
Okay.
I don't think anyone could have done what Barry done. It's funny because the run-ins we've had, Barry's the first to ring me, and he's laughing and joking.
Oh, he loves it,
doesn't
he? He loves publicity.
Like, the big thing, the fallout of the UK Championships, when I said that, you know, about shortening the format and blah, 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 he actually rang me the next day. He'd probably deny all knowledge of this, but he rang me the next day to say, Mark, please say more, because I love this.
Yeah.
And I said to him, Barry, if you pay my fines, I'll say whatever you want me to say. And he says, well, I wouldn't go that far. He says, but I love what you're doing. He says, any publicity is great. And he says, anything I ever say about you in the press, he says, it's not meant any harm, it's just to get headlines. And that is Barry. He's all about headlines and getting people talking about the sport. And look, I run a charity event every year, and Barry Hearn's the first person I ring, because I know that he's going to be the first person to want to support it. So like, these run-ins that people talk about, yes, we had words, but they're never really run-ins that we're going to fall out over. He's actually a really nice guy to talk to. He's someone that if you spoke to him long enough, he'd convince you that the blue sky was black.
Yeah.
But he's a great guy to be around, lots of fun, and what he's done in snooker is just ridiculously good.
Okay, and finally, away from snooker, I mean, you say you've got a young family, I'm sure that takes up a lot of time. What are your other sort of hobbies? I know you like a bit of golf, don't you?
Honestly, at the minute, I've played very, very little golf. I've just been so busy. The calendar's been so busy. Last year, now that we're in the 18, but it's the least I've played golf ever, really, since I was about 17, 18. And it's just, because of the calendar so busy, you don't feel like you're getting a big gap. Within that big gap, I wanted to change queues after the World Championship, so I didn't take really any break after the Worlds. I got my new queue a few weeks later, and then straight back at it to make sure I had plenty of hours with that queue. In general, I like to take a big break in the summer, but because of what happened with the queue, I couldn't do that this year. So, like, socialise with friends and have a few drinks and stuff over the summer when it is a bit quieter. But in general, it's just lots of time at home and lots of practice. It sounds very, very boring, but it had to be done with a new queue, and it's something that might have to be done again this year, because I'm still not happy with my queue that I've got, but it might change again in the summer. But yeah, it'll lend itself to just more and more play.
And finally, you're glad, are you, that you discovered snooker at a young age? It's given you this life you've got.
Absolutely. Look, I'm very, very fortunate that I can play the game that I love for a living. Am I a bit envious of some other sports? Like, people in my position in other sports would be financially secure. You know, their kids would be financially secure. Their kids would probably be financially secure. And people think I'm being, you know, awkward saying this, but it's not all about the money. But it is in the long term. You know, like, I look back at the game and I'll be happy with what I've done or disappointed with what I've not done. But what will make me happiest is knowing my family is secure.
Sure.
And at the minute, I'm nowhere near there. So, yeah, there's still lots of work to do.
Okay, Mark, we wish you all the best for the rest of the season.
Thank you very much, mate.
Cheers, Mark. Sports Social
Podcast Network. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.